Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Tomorrow at noon, local time at the Spearfish Holiday Inn, Women in Networking celebrates women in history. Kelly Kirk is a professor of history at Black Hills State University. She'll highlight a few legendary women in the Black Hills. And Kelly joins us now from the Sue W. White Studio on the campus of Black Hills State University. Professor Kirk, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right, this is all part of Women's History Day. And give us Women in History Month. Give us a big picture look at, you know, sort of the efforts to talk about women's history and the themes behind it this year.
The Women's History Alliance sponsors a kind of a women's history theme every March. And this March 2019, their theme is Visionary Women, Champions of Peace and Nonviolence. And so it's celebrating women who have focused their time and energies on ending conflict, restoring peace and justice, using a whole host of means versus, you know, education, direct action, legal defense funds, etc.
All right. So there's a power in that for sure. And a lot of that history is history that's not always told.
Precisely. And every year, the National Women's History Month does honor kind of national honorees who, you know, are part of this theme, you know, incredible women who are boards of directors and presidents, coordinators of different organizations. And so it's fun to be able to then take that national theme and bring it more locally.
All right. Tell us how we're doing that. When you are starting your research, where do you begin?
My research focus really kind of talks about local women in the Black Hills area, how they interact with their communities, the rest of South Dakota, and even then kind of into their neighboring states and nation. And so actually a lot of the stuff I will be talking about tomorrow in my presentation is research that connects with other work that I've been writing on. I've been working on women in the suffrage movement in the Black Hills. And of course, none of these movements happen in a vacuum. And so the same women who are working on women's suffrage are a part of the American Red Cross. They're in literary societies, fraternal organizations. They're in their communities in other ways. And so I wanted to highlight some women who kind of crossed some of these organizations and their impacts.
What kind of, are these all women of a certain social standing? Do they sort of cross race and culture? Are they all, are you seeing any themes in who these people are or were?
It depends. We see, you know, for example, one of the groups I really want to focus on is the American Red Cross in the Black Hills during World War I. We see a main chapter in Deadwood, but then we also see a branch chapter kind of develop in each of the communities, reaching hundreds of individuals. And it was really interesting because that crosses kind of social structure, class, and even gender. We see men and women, business owners, workers, all kind of coming together in these chapters of the American Red Cross. When it comes to the women's suffrage movement some of the other women, say, like the literary or fraternal societies, I think we tend to see a lot more kind of middle and upper class women. They try and bridge some of those class boundaries. But you also have to have a certain level of, you know, free time to participate you know, that specific interest.
All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the American Red Cross in Deadwood. World War One. That tell us about the women who sort of are working together for this common cause. What's binding them?
It's a really interesting story, and the sheer fact that it's such a large organization. And I think we tend to think South Dakota is pretty far removed from World War One and its effects, and yet we see the state as a whole more than meet their quotas for fundraising and war bond buying. They're incredibly involved in being a part of fundraising and trying to conserve on the home front so that the men on the war front have more. They're hosting classes about cooking, canning, planting your own gardens, how to make more out of less. We're seeing all these really interesting social networks develop as these women work together to provide kind of humanitarian aid, not only for men on the front, but those who have come back injured or ill, the families who are affected back in their communities. And so it kind of both has a global reach, but then also that very kind of staying connected with members of their community.
So I'm thinking about this connectivity and then the geography of the Black Hills and then the technology that's not available to them at the time. So tell me a little bit about your research. Are you finding letters and journals and correspondence to sort of, see how they made some of those connections?
Yes, we see a lot of letters being written between kind of key organizers. And again, in the course of history, some of these letters have been lost. People may not have kept them or archived them, maybe thinking that, you know, their mother or grandmother's letters weren't necessarily worthy of an archive. But you begin to see in the letters we do have references to women time and time again who are involved in these different organizations. And so they know each other really well. And you also see this deep concern on behalf of this community of women about, you know, is so-and-so doing too much? Is she overworking herself because she's, you know, traveling by train across the state for a meeting for the suffrage movement, only to take another late night train back to the Black Hills, then to grab, you know, a coach to get back up to Deadwood, to then, you know, be back for a fundraising event the next day.
All right, so we still have the same problem that, or they had the same problem back then that many women today have. It's just like, I can do one more thing, for a good cause to the point of exhaustion.
Yes, and distance is distance. The idea of distance, I think, in South Dakota and that geography is really fascinating. Yeah. The idea that women were trying to connect from the Black Hills to Pierre, to Huron, to Mitchell, to Sioux Falls, to Yankton. They really are crisscrossing the state at a phenomenal rate, considering how much time it would take to do that.
I want to talk a little bit about those lessons of history. As you continue to do your research, does it continue to reveal, you know, really messages for us today, not only of who laid certain groundwork, but the work that's left to be done? Let's talk a little bit about the lessons of these contributions and how these women live their life for us today.
I think a couple of the really powerful things I've seen in researching these women's community organizations is how passionate they were about their individual communities, but how that passion kind of, I don't know, overcame other boundaries. I love that they wanted to use, their networking or their organizations to better others in the community, both professionally and personally. They really believed in the future of other women, of the men in their community, of the children. And I think that's a really powerful message. You don't have to be a leader, right, on the national or international scale. You can get involved in your local community, and that can have incredible impacts.
Mm. Let's talk about women's suffrage, because that's not something that everyone agrees on, even within the women's suffrage movement. There are different, different motivating factors and different strategies. Where has your research led you in that regard?
A lot of my focus has stayed within kind of the communities of Lead and Deadwood. We see some really impressive women who are trying to be part of the statewide suffrage organization. And they tend to be, I think you kind of see a trend where a lot of them are in some ways partners with their husbands. For example, Mrs. Mabel Ruman is married to one of the main telephone companies in Deadwood. She would help him keep his books. She would help him run his business. And on top of that, she worked with the Red Cross. She worked for the suffrage movement. And so you see, I think, her trying to find even more opportunities to be involved. We see Martha Bullock, again, the wife of the very famous Seth Bullock. Many said that she was actually the kind of backbone there, because she might have been quieter and less well known, but she kind of moved very successfully in the background, trying to build a community for Deadwood and use her connections to make Deadwood more of a community for families and children, and not just a mining town.
Right. She's very interesting to me. We recently had an Images of the Past segment with her, or you know, about her, and I thought, you know, isn't it fascinating how we introduce her as Seth Bullock's wife, but really she doesn't need that association at all with the accomplishments that she had, other than that's part of who she was.
Right, and that she was able, I think, to benefit from his connections, but she also, I think, understood that, you know, in many ways, her and Seth worked toward the same goals. They wanted a Deadwood that brought in families and businesses and was more stable than just a mineral community. And then they both worked, albeit in their own ways, but they both worked towards that same goal together. And I think that sometimes that also gets lost in the story.
How much are you seeing, you know, is tied into this idea of literacy and reading and, you know, education and learning? Is that part of everything that they're doing, all these women? That's a key, you know, libraries and things like that are a key component of who they are and what they see has value?
Very much so. You know, Martha herself is really well known for being a leader. They call her a leader of social reform, and that she helped develop all of these literary, musical organizations for community members. She was one of the founding members of what was known as the Round Table Club, which was kind of the who's who of Deadwood society. But it was women who all wanted to, for example, start the first library. Libraries were seen as a way for personal and professional growth, for self-education, for kind of a meeting space, and they wanted their community to have one. We see, you know, bringing in speakers and, you know, trying to start literary societies to get people talking about books and culture, to enjoy or to, you know, present on topics. And if you kind of go through meeting minutes, which are actually one of my favorite historical documents, oddly enough, they're fascinating in who's presenting and what topics these women are researching on. It was expected they would come with a full presentation on the topic of the week, whether that was Charles Dickens or, you know, any other author or even a political topic of the time. And they were supposed to present and then lead a discussion.
Is there anything in there that says what they presented or just the topic? Because now that makes me wonder, you know, you're sitting here doing history and they're doing it as well in their time, but they have far fewer resources than you do. Do you see where they got their research and how deep it was? How good of researchers were they?
It really, to be honest, to find some of those details, it really depends on the group and their meeting minutes. Some organizations had secretaries who kept track of every conversation, and those are my favorite. Yeah. But you do get kind of a sense that these women were digging into their books. They were asking their friends and others that they knew who, you know, might be, you know, really passionate about a topic or really informed. They were going to the newspapers. They were subscribing to literary magazines and trying to kind of pull the sources that they had together into kind of one coherent topic. Mm-hmm. And you do hear things like, you know, the presenter this week gave a thoughtful and enlightening presentation on this topic and how it applies to this situation in our community. And I find it interesting that even that they were not only talking about their issue, but then pointing out, you know, this is how it applies to, you know, Deadwood in 1910.
Right. Do you see that your research, that the thoughtful and enlightening presentation that you're about to give, how would you answer that question for women of today or women and men of today in the Black Hills, from looking back?
I think that one of the things I always want to kind of leave with, and this is always one of my goals in this presentation, is kind of the lessons of history, what we can take away from these stories. And again, finding the opportunities for development, kind of finding a niche to get involved in at whatever level, and really the one thing that I have loved about studying the women's organizations in the Black Hills is just the sheer power of their connections and that idea of that community that they created for each other that's much larger than the Black Hills community. You know, this reaches out to their connections in Washington, D.C., throughout the rest of South Dakota. And I feel that oftentimes, again, people sometimes feel removed from the larger narrative or that larger history. And I'm pretty sure when Mabel Rubin began getting involved with the Red Cross or the women's suffrage movement, or when Martha Bullock first founded the Roundtable Club, they never anticipated who it would put them in contact with or how that would impact their community.
Right. And this goes back to the whole, you know, Women in Networking or WIN group. And if you're just tuning in, my guest is Professor Kelly Kirk from Black Hill State University, and we're talking about celebrating women in history. That meeting is Tuesday, March 12th from noon to 1 local time in the 76 room at the Spearfish Holiday Inn. And Professor Kirk, I'm wondering about, before I let you go, this notion of, you know, when you look at women's marches today, the women's suffrage movement in general, are you seeing indications of how these women sort of intersected with women of color? Is it problematic to look back at how some of these women sort of handled maybe indigenous women or black women or you know, women immigrants or migrants who had come in other capacities to the Black Hills? Do you see that at all, or a tendency to want to do better in that regard?
I think it's one of those, it's kind of the other side of the lessons in history.
Yeah.
The knowledge that that as much as we want to celebrate what some of these women accomplished or did, that there's still room for growth and improvement. And I think that we can kind of see from them, there were certain immigrant populations in South Dakota in the women's suffrage movement that were kind of targeted as being less than supportive of suffrage. And often they were just kind of painted in broad brushstrokes, not necessarily looking into details or trying to maybe understand where that population was coming from, or even trying to reach individuals. You'd often just say like, oh, this was a community of immigrants, and they were, you know, less than receptive.
Right.
And so I think it provides an opportunity for us to discuss how we can do this differently. And I think that's a really actual powerful conversation. And as uncomfortable as it might be to both recognize the success that these women had or what they did accomplish, and then try and point out, you know, here's where it could have been better, that's an important component that it gives us a place to start.
Professor Kelly Kirk, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Sounds like a fascinating presentation.
Well, thank you so much for visiting with me and having me on air.